Welcome to The Sound of Economics, a podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I'm Alicia García Herrero.
And today we will talk about China-India relations and why they matter for Europe and for the rest of the world. This episode is part of Bruegel's Focus on Global China as seen from Europe, which includes our monthly newsletter Zhonghua Mundus and the China Horizons project. You will find links for both of them in the show notes. I'm happy to host Jagannath Panda, who is the head of the Stockholm Center for South Asian and Indo-Pacific Affairs and an expert on China, East Asia and the Indo-Pacific. Hi, Jagannath. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, JP, and hello, Alicia. Great to meet both of you and happy to talking to this Bruegel podcast.
Great. Where are you connecting from?
Oh, okay. I'm speaking from Stockholm.
Great, great. At The Sound of Economics, we have been already exploring China's relations with Sri Lanka and with the Balkan. Today, we will continue this overview of China's relations with strategic regions, and India could not be missed out from our list. Firstly, because India is posited to become one of the world's top economies. Some people say India is the next China, a country of more than a billion people with the potential of growing at 10% a year for a long period. Secondly, because India and China have often competed for strategic dominance in the international and regional order and continue to be embroiled in border disputes. For example, on 15 June 2020, Chinese troops, estimated to be more than 250, attacked a group of 50 Indian soldiers who were inspecting the progress of the Chinese withdrawal from the Indian side of the line of actual control in the Golwan Valley. The encounter ended in the deaths of 20 Indian soldiers and an undeclared number of Chinese troops, and led to the prolonged standoff between the two sides along this line. Thirdly, despite their differences, the two have also cooperated in bilateral, regional, and multinational forums in the past and in the present, including the Russia-India-China High-Level Trilateral, also called RIC, or wider regional configurations, such as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Last but not least, India-China relations are crucial within the global geopolitical arena and the relations with the US and the EU. We are going to explore all these aspects, and let's start with the setting the scene. Jagannath, can you help us to understand the current economic position of India and its potential for growth?
Well, that's a very interesting question, GP, and thank you very much for that introduction. In fact, let me start by making this point that if we talk about, you know, every and each country in the international arena today, I think their international standing and foreign policy posturing depends upon how strong they economically are. And therefore, and I think we need to have a stock analysis about India's economic standing in global affairs today. Undoubtedly, India is a strong economy in the world ranking today. It is the fifth largest economy. And recently, it has surpassed the UK, United Kingdom, to become the fifth largest economy. And today, it stands, you know, right behind the United States of America, China, Japan, and Germany. So therefore, India, when it comes to, you know, economic standing, India is one of those top-ranking economic power today. And therefore, it is very much, you know, well ingrained and linked with the global affairs. And today also, if we see different forecasts that is coming from different credible institutions, including from the IMF, International Monetary Fund, which actually forecast Indian GDP to be on the rising side. And, you know, it has recently said that Indian GDP is going to reach very soon, you know, by the end of 2022 and early 2023. Something up to $3.53 trillion, and that's a big number in the context of India's rising economic profile. There is also a forecast that the GDP growth rate in India would be almost be around 8% to 10%, 10.5%, which is also a really impressive and stable sign about Indian economic graph. If we take into the post-pandemic world, particularly the kind of GDP growth we have seen about other emerging economies, including that of China, even though there is a debate about Chinese economy, whether this is a developing economy or a developed economy. But still, if we see in a comparative graph, I think Indian economy is poised to do well, and that's a positive sign. But again, I think if we really talk about India's economic position in global affairs today, we have to actually talk more about India's domestic economic constituency. How is it going to fare? How is it going to perform in times to come? And therefore, there are a number of critical sectors that would invariably be, shaping up India's economic fortune in times to come. For example, if we talk about the domestic economic constituency in India, the inflation is rising. That's a problematic trend. It's not really rising, today or in recent past. I think this trend has been quite visible for some time, and that's not a very healthy sign. Similarly, unemployment is also rising, and unemployment has been a constant problem for the last one decade or so. And that is a continuous problem in Indian economy, that the Indian economy is not really embraced to the full-scale employment opportunity for its youth and rising dynamic young population. Similarly, if we talk about the other domestic sectors, manufacturing sector is also facing some problem. We know that manufacturing sector is witnessing a continuous revolution and positive growth and upward trend in Indian economic sectors in the domestic constituency. But again, there are larger manufacturing sectors which is still struggling in India. Similarly, if we talk about the agricultural sector, it's not really doing well. There have been continuous, pandemic. There has been continuous, natural calamities which India is facing, and the agricultural sector is continuously, suffering. And similarly, the youth today, which is the crux of Indian population today, the youth is not really embraced and embracing agricultural sector as their future sector, and therefore all of these issues are becoming, problems for India's economy. And also, we should not forget about the urban India and the rural India, the kind of gap which is, expanding from time to time. There are, sectors in rural India which is not really business friendly. And as a result, India is unable to invite foreign investors to invest in rural India. And these are the problematic aspects of Indian economy. So therefore, even though there are credible institutions, multilateral institutions like IMF is forecasting that Indian economy is on the rising scale, but then there are problematic aspects on the domestic front, which the regime in Delhi, the government in Delhi has to overcome in order to put the Indian economic position on a rising scale.
Thank you for this overview, Jagannath. I'm looking at Alicia especially because you've been making a comparison with China's growth, and China's economy is used to grow faster than India, and India's economic dependence on China has grown over time, but the former is no longer the case. But what about the latter from your perspective?
Yeah. Well, here are a few numbers just to complement what Jagannath has told us. So basically, China came to the era of globalization before India for a number of reasons related also to India's domestic policies, which, by the way, India has moved away from, and China is somehow getting into, in terms of self-reliance and domestic industrialization, etc. So it's kind of ironic, but when China came into the global economy with this proposition from Deng Xiaoping that reform and opening up, it was the time where the world was looking to offshore anywhere, efficiency was everything, And the industrial sector was very big because manufacturing was kind of the, I wouldn't say the only game in town, but frankly, services were very small in terms of cross-border trade, I mean, trading services. So in that regard, one could argue that China came to the global economy at the right time. But at the same time, and maybe because of that reason, having pushed the envelope, if I may use that expression, and having now the world becoming increasingly wary about excessive reliance on China, there you go. You have an economy, which is India, which is basically potentially of the same size if you think about population, but also in many ways skills, etc. You can argue that that's the next China. Of course, this is hard to tell because the world is in a different phase. You know, we are in this globalization phase. So that has challenges. The world is also in the climate change crisis. So, you know, the production of goods might not necessarily be the most urgent matter. Maybe, you know, we want to focus on producing less, but with less emissions, or at least, you know, the combination is certainly not the same. But maybe the good thing about this is that India, in a way, is more akin to that type of reality because the service sector is large. And the question is that type of reality more, I mean, is China, I would say, is India coming actually, ironically, at the right time? Because the type of world we have now with service-oriented, more service-oriented FDI might be more akin to India than to China. So that's the interesting thing. And finally, in terms of growth, China has been exhausting its low-hanging fruits. By that, I mean urbanization is already at a very high level, nearly 60%. So it can go 10 percentage points more, maybe 70 like Brazil or Mexico. But India is very much lower than China. So that easy kind of low-hanging fruit of growth might be there for quite some time. And that's positive, yeah, because it's not only about receiving FDI or depending on somebody else's interest to invest, but your own engines of growth. So that's maybe the way I would answer that question in terms of big opportunities for India for those two reasons I just mentioned. Yeah.
And coming to the core of what we want to discuss today, which is the relations between China and India, Jagannath, I would like to ask you to give us some more details related to how these relations are evolving, both on the side of the challenges. I was mentioned some beforehand, but also on the side of the positives of this relation.
I think I'll just try to link what Alicia was speaking, and that's an interesting point, what she was making. And I'll add by saying that, you know, if we are have to have a, you know, good analysis about China-India relations, we have to understand their economic standing in comparative sense. Even though it is unfair to compare because, you know, today the Chinese economy is four times higher than the Indian economy. Four times larger than the Indian economy. So therefore, it is a little unfair. But again, I think it is the Indian economy, the GDP growth rate of India that overtook China in 2015. Under Xi Jinping's leadership, what we have seen, the Chinese economists started calling it as a new normal in their GDP economy because their GDP, their growth rate was not really doing well. And all of these economic indicators has a reflection in their bilateral relationship. Today, what we have seen that when China is approaching towards India, China is operating from a position of strength. From a position of strength because the Chinese economy is four times higher than India. But on the other hand, India is performing well, and there is an amount of confidence is reflected in India's, you know, foreign policy behavior. Because India's GDP is on a rising scale and it is relatively doing better than the Chinese GDP. So therefore, India is confident and gaining confidence on its day-to-day affairs. So therefore, there is a positive inclination in India's foreign policy approach, which is coming as a challenge to China. And we know for a fact that there is a problematic boundary dispute between China and India. And China is creating, you know, pressures on India, trying to change the status quo by claiming new land territorial issues on the Western sector, in the middle sector, and also in the Eastern sector. And this is a very complicated boundary dispute between China and India. But the economic standing between China and India has their reflections in their foreign policy behavior. So today, when we are talking about China's aggressiveness on India on the boundary dispute, China's aggressiveness and assertiveness on India on many other global issues, including some of the bilateral and regional foreign policy issues, we have to keep it in mind that the Chinese are operating from a position of strength because their economy is 4 times higher than the Indian economy. And therefore, they are today sounding very strong, very, you know, positive. But on a practical reality, that China is under stress. And today, when we try to understand from the China's domestic point of view, there is a, you know, problematic trend which is happening between urban China and rural China. The income level between urban China and rural China is expanding. And there is unemployment is massively rising in China. People are feeling very suffocated. And all of these things are the part of the larger domestic problems that Xi Jinping has to manage. And therefore, in order to divert those attentions, China is creating a nationalist feeling by creating problems over India on the boundary dispute. So therefore, this trend has become a very usual trend in China-India bilateral relations. So therefore, in times to come, we will see that the Chinese leadership employing this kind of strategy in order to divert the Chinese people's attention from the core domestic problems, and they would try to create more, you know, problems with India in order to create that nationalist sentiment within China against India. They are creating the same against US. They are creating the same against Japan. They are creating the same nationalist sentiment against Taiwan. And today they are also successfully creating the same nationalist sentiment against India. So that is the strategy that the Chinese Communist Party is employing. And today the Chinese Communist Party has become seen India as more as a rivaling country, as a rival country, as a competing economy in the neighborhood. So therefore the China-India relations is continuously witnessing a problematic downwards trend. And this downwards trend will continue to be there. And probably in times to come, after the 20th National Congress of the Chinese Communist Party, there will be more nationalist element coming up in China's behavior towards India. And we'll see the PLA and the Chinese Communist Party creating more troubles for India to affect the China-India relations. So I'm not very optimistic about the future of China-India relations, to be very honest.
But Jagannath, as I was mentioning before, there is another element to be considered in the region, and I would like to ask your opinion on that, which is the Russia element, and also this regional fora where India and China keep participating, such as the Russia-India-China high-level trilateral, and as I was saying before, the Shanghai cooperation, and also, you know, in light of Russia's invasions of Ukraine, we've been discussing quite a lot in the media about China's role. But what about the role of India?
Well, when we're talking about the Russia factor, we have to understand that Russia is a traditional partner for India from the time of the Soviet Union. So what we have essentially seen that India used to enjoy a very stable relationship with the Soviet Union. So, and later, when after the disintegration of the Soviet Union, Russia emerged as a natural partner for India. And this partnership is very much unidimensional in some sectors. India-Russia partnership is not really comprehensive one. Like many other partnership, India's relationship with Japan, India's relationship with US, India-Russia relationship is very much restricted to few areas. It is restricted to the defense sector, where India purchases almost 60% of the military equipments from Russia. It is restricted to the energy sectors. It is restricted to the multilateral sectors. And there comes the China factor. The very fact that India is in good touch with Russia. That helps India to overcome the China challenge in the multilateral forums. And the forums you mentioned about, Russia, India, China, trilateral, it helps India to balance out China regionally. Similarly, when we talk about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, you know, Shanghai Cooperation Organization is essentially a China-dominated body, and it was founded by China, as you know. But today, because India is a member, so Russia and India try to have some influence over the Shanghai Cooperation Organizations, which checks the Chinese complete dominance. Similarly, if we talk about, you know, other multilateral forums like Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank, after China, both India and Russia are the two largest voting shareholder in the AIIB. And that helps actually not to allow the AIIB to become completely a China-dominated body. So therefore, you know, this multilateral chain of contacts between India, Russia, and China comes as a balancer in the larger global politics, particularly in terms of checking the Chinese, you know, unilateral behavior regionally.
Alicia, what is your take on what we just heard about this regional level? Because this adds quite a complexity on the bilateral relation.
I would say that I would have agreed with Jagannath if Russia had not invaded Ukraine, but it has invaded Ukraine. So I just don't think that India can even dream, sorry to use the word, of having an independent Russia that will support India in the case of a conflict with China. That's out of, in my opinion, of imagination. Because by now, Russia is a vassal of the Chinese regime. And this is simply because without China, and especially the export of semiconductors, which are keeping Russia's military industry alive, even if with difficulties, as we all see, there's no way that Russia can, that will not have to pay off for that. So in a way, I understand the limitations, because as I fully agree with Jagannath that you cannot move away from your largest source of military equipment in a day or two. That's very clear. But I do think that it would be important, in my view, I mean, that would be what I would do. That doesn't mean, that doesn't have to be right or by all means, but I think it is important to realize that the world will be different after Ukraine. And I would say no matter how Ukraine ends, because even if there is an agreement of any sort, Russia will continue to massively depend as ever before on the Chinese economy. And by the way, China will not depend on Russia. And the best example of that is the deal with Qatar that we just saw on the news. So the unbalanced relation will remain unbalanced. And that's, China is very aware of that and will not depend on Russia's gas beyond a certain needed amount. So for India, to me, what this means is that when push comes to shove, the support might not be there. The military support might not be there. That's my reading of the situation. So it's a long-term question. I understand that it cannot be dealt with immediately, but it's a very important security question, in my opinion, for India down the road.
Jagannath, of course, we could speak for much longer about the regional situation, but we need to move on to another connected element of the puzzle. We went from the economics to geopolitics at regional level. We're going to get back to geopolitics at the global level and relations with the EU in a second. But first, getting back to internal issues and how the internal political evolution is affecting, or will affect, because this is part of what we were just discussing in relation with Russia, India's positioning internationally, and of course also in relation with China. And I'm especially here referring to the status of India's democracy and the fact that Narendra Modi's tenure has downgraded the country to an electoral autocracy, echoing what is going on in Hungary, Turkey, and in other parts of the world. So what is your take on the relation between this political evolution and the relations that are going to unfold in the next near future?
I think it is subject to interpretation. I would not say that that India under the current regime has become an electoral autocracy. What we are seeing is a contested perspective where there is a strong government which is coming to power again and again, and which is a strong, domestic and foreign policy posturing we are seeing from Delhi. So therefore, there is obvious reasons, obvious interpretation that probably, India is witnessing a change, and the status of India is turning into becoming an electoral autocracy. But that's not really the correct picture. India is a strong democracy. It has a robust parliamentary democratic system. We are a federal system. In fact, if you see, there is always a strong regional government at the state, which is not in the same line as with the central government in India. So I don't think any government will be able to change that so rapidly. And I think what we are seeing is a strong government in Delhi, but again, very diversified federal system in India. So I think Indian system is very stable when it comes to India as a parliamentary democracy. Of course, sometimes, many media interpretations, many scholars, thinkers, they might not really like the current government's policy posturing, because some of this policy posturing might be hard in nature. But to say that India has moving towards to become an electoral autocracy would not really be a correct interpretation. And I think for the last 60, 70 years has been a resilient democracy and has faced many domestic problems. And such kind of interpretations is very subjective in nature. And it will pass through, I think, once there is a government change in Delhi happening.
But Jagannath, you might value the fact that these different interpretations have validity, because they also have data support, and things might be interpreted differently, and that also the rise of Hindu nationalists, it's not something to be ignored.
Well, India is a multi-ethnic and multi-diversified country. So there will be always different media platforms to write, 1,000 critical pieces to, which is always missing in China. In China, we cannot really be critical to the current government or the current regime. But that's not the case in India. So it depends what we are reading and what we are observing. So therefore, I would not really question those data or the interpretation. But what I would say is that at the end of the day, we need to rely on the correct feeding, correct news sources in order to have a correct assessment.
Thank you for that. I don't know if Alicia wants to add anything on this point. Otherwise, I would like to go on with the place of Europe in all this, and how the relations between Europe and India are evolving. I mean, there is currently a negotiation for a trade agreement going on, and maybe Alicia can help me framing that aspect before I give back the mic to Jagannath.
Yes, maybe beyond the the obviously very important relations between India and the US, India and Russia, as we've heard, and other forms of regional cooperation. We can't forget that the largest investor as of today in India is the European Union. And therefore, I think it's quite important to discuss about the economics of it and what the European Union can bring to the table in the light of negotiations that started in May 2021, and where we can take it from there. So that would be the question for Jagannath.
I mean, if we try to see about Europe's perspective towards India-China, I think it has to be depending on what kind of issues we are talking about. Europe might not really have a very well-balanced approach towards India-China relations, because both India-China are having a lot of complicated issues. And from Europe's point of view, they don't actually, Europe or the EU does not have to take a formal position on the India-China boundary dispute, because the India-China boundary dispute is a bilateral one and it has to be resolved bilaterally between India and China. But I think what has to be, and taking forward your questions, how should Europe place itself in the India-China complicated relations? I think today what we are seeing, Europe's relationship with China is becoming very complicated for obvious reasons. The kind of posturing, the kind of, you know, foreign policy, outlook that the Chinese are unfolding in the entire Europe, and particularly the way China has actually been supportive of Russia's invasion in Ukraine. So therefore, Europe is questioning about China, and therefore the time has come to question China on a multiple issues, not only on these particular issues, but about the Belt and Road initiatives, but about the Chinese Communist Party's functioning, on the human rights issues, on the Xinjiang episode. So a lot of range of issues in China needs to be questioned. And therefore, there has to be a parity of understanding between Europe and India. Of course, Europe's expectations from India is also very high. EU and Europe, the broader European continent probably expects India to be much more sympathetic towards the Ukraine crisis, which India is actually, officially India is sympathetic towards the Ukrainians' cause. And India is supporting the humanitarian aid to the Ukrainians, assistance and for the rehabilitation. But again, India is very caught also in a very delicate position when it comes to the war between Russia and Ukraine. So therefore, I think Europe's expectations from India cannot be only based on this factor. Europe has to see India from a very broader point of view as an emerging power. There are, you know, a range of issues where Europe can actually cooperate with India on energy sector, on renewable energy sector, on cyber issues, on space programs, on science and technology, on educational exchanges, including on trade and economy. So therefore, today when we are having, you know, a talk about EU's approach towards Asian powers, there is a revision happening in EU's approach towards Asian powers. Earlier, EU's approach towards Asia was very much China dimensional, China oriented. But today we are seeing there is a change is happening, and there is a much more concentrated efforts in the EU circuit to focus on Japan and India, the two other economies in the Asian region. And that's a welcome initiative. And I think we need to strengthen on that. And today, when we're talking about EU's Indo-Pacific strategy, India becomes a natural partner to that point of view. So today we are seeing countries like, you know, France, Germany, Netherlands, they are willing to you know, cooperate with India bilaterally. So therefore, I think when we're talking about Europe's place in the complicated India-China relations, it doesn't have to be on a defined sense. It has to be defined from issue to issue basis, on a case-to-case basis. So therefore, we need to talk about which case, which area we are talking about, and there is a great scope of cooperation awaiting between Europe and India in times to come.
Thank you. And Alicia, would you like to add anything on that point of the Europe role within this frame before we go towards the end of this episode?
Yes, I in the same way as India has remained neutral on the invasion of Ukraine, I guess there couldn't be any expectation that you will not remain neutral on border issues between China and India. So in that regard, I mean, it was never the expectation that, from my side at least, that this would be different. However, I think the idea of working together on a multilateral, more multilateral world from the perspective of no matter our common size, but, you know, of what we really are, we're still a middle power, because there's only two, as we speak, or so they see the world, great powers in this great power competition. I think it's in our interest actually to collaborate. Just on this note of whether it's at the national or the European level, it all depends on how you see Europe, you know, depending on which policy we're talking about. I was referring to the negotiations for trade or investment agreement or both, a comprehensive economic agreement with India, which is what is now happening. And I think Europe's expectations on India that are described as perhaps too aggressive, I think they only show, how Europe sees the world. It's not about India. Europe sees the world based on labor rights and climate change considerations. And that may be perceived as very high standards. But on the other hand, I think it's a question of alignment of objectives more than perhaps high standards. But on that note, I will leave it there. And thank you so much. It's been very interesting.
So thank you, Jagannath. I think we could discuss for much longer about that. And we will come back to this because it's extremely important and key to understand the relations with China, but also the global landscape. So India will certainly be a topic of conversation that will come back in the next months. And I would like to remind everyone that this episode was part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes our monthly newsletter Zhonghua Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe, the link is in the show notes, and our new project China Horizons, which also has a link in the show notes. As usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website www.bruegel.org. Jagannath, Alicia, thanks a lot for joining this conversation.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, GP.
And thanks to our listeners for following us. Until next time, bye-bye.